Occult Confessions is brought to you commercial-free through the generous support of our patrons. Visit occultconfessions.com and click on donate to keep the history of the occult on the digital airwaves.
August 15th, 1979. 16-year-old James Dallas Egbert III was reported missing from his Michigan State University dorm, leaving behind a suicide note, and after two failed suicide attempts, was returned to his family roughly a month later after being discovered by private investigator William Deere, only to succeed in taking his life August 16th of the following year. June 9th, 1982, Irving Bink Pulling decided to take his own life by shooting himself in the chest. Bink's mother, left distraught and trying to find answers as to why her son would have done such a horrific act, came to the same conclusion as William Deere. These boys had lost their ability to discern fantasy from reality because of the role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons. My name is Luke Kinneman, the producer of Discordia at Occult Confessions, joined today by the ever-inquisitive sister of the 84th degree, Savannah Verrett.
Hello, and happy to be talking about Dungeons & Dragons, and forcing Rob to listen to me talk about Dungeons & Dragons.
Speaking of Rob, also joining us, the Supreme Hierophant, Dr. Rob C. Thompson.
That, I think, and this says something, Luke, is one of the saddest openings we've had on the show.
Yes. I was also thinking the same thing.
Oh, well.
You're just going to take the compliment.
I guess.
It's dark
stuff, man.
I don't
have any other way to turn it around.
Is there any more suicide in today's episode?
There's murder.
Okay, but you front-loaded the suicide on us.
Yeah. Get it out in the open. Set the tone. We're going to continue to talk about those individuals. But get additional context as to why things happened and why they're so key to the panic that existed around Dungeons & Dragons during the 1980s.
Well, so belated trigger warning then.
Sorry, my bad.
Well, we will be discussing some unpleasant subject matter this day.
But do we get to talk about like actual fun stuff too? Or is it just going to be that the whole time?
No, there'll be fun stuff. Okay. I have things planned.
Okay.
As is customary, we will skirt the line between fun and depression.
We the members
of the Secret Order of Alchemical Actors do solemnly commit ourselves to a full and honest telling of the history of the occult as far as we know it.
We're
going to open up that Order of Confessors, Luke.
Yeah. Now, if I recall, there is no conventional noise to do that anymore, right?
It could be any noise at all, really.
I have the perfect noise. It's just a little bit of Foley. Oh,
I love
Foley
that.
And foreshadowing.
Oh. We want to get back to the business of thanking patrons because, you know, we've been doing a lot of fancy stuff, interviews and non-Rob episodes, which is continuing today, but I wanted to break in a little bit and thank some folks. And we still got more folks to thank after this list, but just getting caught up. We have Matthew M, Athena F, Bailey M, SH, also known as Shh.
Well, if it's just SH, it's probably like just Shh.
It's an abrupt. Stuart MC, Cody C, Ben, and Lindsay, welcome to our family of patrons. Also, we got a pledge bump from Ray D and Kelly H. And again, that's not an exhaustive list. I will get caught up with more patrons next time.
Thank you.
All right, we'll toss it back to you, Luke. We got to make a sound, though.
Oh, I started at Savannah. You close it.
Bop. God damn it, Luke. I wasn't prepared for this.
But you
do
did make
foliage
a sound.
Again. I did. But I'm not happy with it. So
what did you call it?
That's the best kind.
Did you call it foliage?
Foliage.
I don't know what you called it.
Foley.
His foley.
Foley? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Foley. Sorry, I'm ready to talk about Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, that's fair. I won't explain what Foley is. It's not that
exciting.
It's exciting.
I'm sorry.
Now the audience
now
is
I feel bad.
Though.
I didn't
ahead,
mean it
Luke.
Like that.
No, the but audience people all already know what Foley is.
Some don't.
I don't.
The purpose of Foley additionally act as a way to essentially ADR sound effects in a scene after something has been filmed, or create the illusion of something happening by adding additional sound after the filming and the recording has taken place.
Which could involve foliage.
It could. Like a common one is like breaking celery and things like that to emulate breaking bones. So it's fun things like that. Or hitting a stack of leather jackets with a baseball bat because it sounds like a very impactful punch.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, that is cool.
Yeah. Our primary source today is Joseph Laycock's book, Dangerous Games, What the Moral Panic of Role-Playing Games Says About Play, Religion, and Imagined Worlds. Now, before we delve deeper and kind of further into some of the tragedies that we started with at the beginning of the episode with James Egbert and Irving Pulling, it's imperative to understand what was causing this panic for parents, specifically those of the new Christian right, primarily including evangelical Protestants and Roman Catholics, who fell more on the conservative side of the political spectrum, who had painted a target on the back of the Dungeons & Dragons role-playing game, which, as we get further into it, it seems more and more questionable as to why they would target such a thing. It's very much something that they targeted without really know what's going on, at least from my perspective.
Politically, the Christian right, though, is ascendant at this moment. I mean, we're getting into moral majority stuff. We're a decade off from Pat Robertson's candidacy, Buchanan. I mean, the Christian right is on the move as far as politics are concerned.
Yeah. And we're also getting into Savannah territory as we're entering into the 80s.
Yes, Reagan.
I was like, why?
Reagan. Reagan was a fascinating figure, though, in relation to the Christian right, because while they liked him and he paid lip service to him, his actual social policies often didn't go far enough for them, and he sort of just kept them at arm's length.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Like, so I mean, just enough to get their vote, and then, like, he just did what he wanted?
Well, yeah, I mean, the man, like, he lived in a post-Roe v. Wade world and did nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And he was president for 8 years.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not ideal.
Not ideal.
I don't know how else to phrase it.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't move quickly on gay rights either, or any of that, you know, the AIDS pandemic and that sort of stuff. So, you know, it's not like he was a darling of the left, but he also wasn't a darling of the Christian right.
Yeah. He sort was of a just misconception. Kind of, you know, milquetoast middle of the road.
I mean, but don't we miss that these days?
Yeah,
I would be pretty content with someone just being not exactly overly passionate about either side and just kind of existing.
Yeah, just stop the forest fires and I'm good to go.
Yeah, you know, maybe get rid of some of my gray hair that way. We'll see. Now, for those of you that are unfamiliar, Dungeons & Dragons was originally created by Gary Gygax and David Arneson, two, coincidentally, Christians. Gygax, of which had also spent part of his life as a Jehovah's Witness. Gygax and Arneson initially published the first edition of Dungeons & Dragons through Gygax's company, Tactical Studies Rules, or TSR, with the rights to which later being purchased by Wizards of the Coast, who currently still owns the Dungeons & Dragons RPG, and that was purchased back in 1997.
What did Wizards of the Coast even do before they owned Dungeons & Dragons? I just assumed that they were a thing because of Dungeons & Dragons.
No, do you know? No. So, as far as I know, they still owned Magic back then. They still had quite a few other properties. But
did they create Magic?
I believe so. I've played very little Magic. I've been to like a few like events where you you buy packs and then you build a deck from those packs. But Magic is for a much smarter individual than I.
It's a lot of math, right?
Yeah. And I like my math in the form of rocks, which is a colloquialism for what people call the dice use for D&D, just math rocks.
But so their money came probably through the card games.
Yes, and then they kind of focused on acquisitions so they can expand that kind of fantasy universe. Because there are Faerun, which is where the primary world of Dungeons and Dragons, for lack of better words, kind of takes place. There has been so many crossovers between Magic and Faerun and different things that kind of expand into it a bit. So it just seemed like a smart move from them. And at the same time, TSR was a relatively small company. So, I mean, initially the first edition was published and printed out of Gygax's basement.
That's crazy that it was able to grow, blow up and be this like huge thing like this now. I love that. That's so awesome.
Well, I mean, before he got in, because he used to play a lot of war games similar to games like Bolt Action now, which are focused more in recreating historical battles that have taken place and less about like fantasy and less about role playing. D&D being one of the first, you know, functionally one of the first role playing games in a fantasy setting that really took off. Both Arneson and Gygax also had predecessors to D&D that kind of led to its creation. But after, you know, Wizards of the Coast purchased it, Gygax was just kind of hands off, which makes sense. It's no longer his property. But with that being said, D&D, as it's commonly known, it's a fantasy role-playing game currently in its fifth edition with the new edition 1 D&D expected to release this year after some playtesting. We'll see how it goes. Time will tell.
They're going to release one?
Yeah.
I'm confused already. Shouldn't they have done that at the beginning?
Well, they did. They had first edition. But this is 1 D&D and not D&D 1.
I give up already.
Excellent. I mean, what are your thoughts on Microsoft's naming schemes for the Xbox? PlayStation has the PlayStation, PlayStation 2, 3, and it just, you know, makes sense in a numerical order.
Xbox 360, Xbox One, Xbox X, Series X.
No.
Well, it just has to have the letter X in it, I guess.
Yeah. And a box of some degree. But 1 D&D is expected to release this year. And in order to kind of simplify everything and give anyone who is not familiar with the core mechanics of the game, there is essentially two primary roles that exist in the game. The party, or the players who make up that party, and the DM, or the dungeon master. Now, the DM's role is to create a story for the players and essentially guide them through an adventure through narration, the adventure being that of their own creation or one that has been published as a module. So, for example, Savannah and some of the other members of Call Confessions are currently playing through
The Curse of Strahd.
The Curse of Strahd, which
and is... And we are getting our asses handed to us by vampires. Sorry.
Love to hear it.
Yeah. Well, it is, what do you mean, witches? It's a module, so like it's like a full-blown story that Bree is our DM, and she is like going through the module, and it's telling her what happens when we get to certain places, and then she has to kind of improv off of us how we interact with the surroundings and stuff. So
yeah, it's the framework for an adventure in a box, essentially. It's if you want to get into playing Dungeons and Dragons, you have no... You don't really want to create your own campaign. There are a plethora of different campaigns that exist as these modules that have been published by Wizards of the Coast in order to make, you know, the game more accessible for people.
So those are your two options. You can start from nothing and like a rule book essentially and build your whole story, or you can take a story that's already written.
Those are the two main options primarily. Okay. Yeah. So I'm currently running a campaign that is, fully fleshed out story that I've just been creating, and it's growing with the players and the lore is being built as they make their decisions and their actions, and I'm working on, you know, the opposite side of the screen, so they don't know what's happening on my end, and I'm making decisions and determining things and calibrating things to be reflective of their actions without an existing story already taking place.
But what Gygax did was establish a rule book on how to do this.
Exactly. He created the rule set.
And so that's it's not what you like, use.
Yeah, we use this rule set, and that's how we determine our successes and our failures. And that rule set not only is a key component to the DM, but also a key component to the players. So
yeah, would you say that hasn't changed over time? It hasn't changed much, that core set of rules?
It drastically changes.
Oh, it's drastically changed.
When I first started playing, about, I don't know, 17 or 18 years ago. The first edition that I really got my hands on was Dungeons & Dragons 3.5. Fourth edition was out, but it was very polarizing for people. So they were kind of going back to third edition or going to this kind of halfway point where it wasn't, the full fourth edition wasn't complete, and they were just kind of playing with some modified rules in third edition. And as new editions come out, essentially things get streamlined and simplified to make it a more accessible game for people.
Yeah, just, because there is an unbelievable amount of rules. Like,
yeah,
you honestly, playing Dungeons and Dragons is like, is super, it's so much fun, but it's also super hard because there's so many rules that it's almost impossible for you to know all of the rules. Like,
so you have to stop and check.
Yes, but also it almost feels like, to me, like, Whose Line Is It Anyway, where it's like the rules are made up and the points don't matter or whatever. That's kind of how I like to play Dungeons and Dragons.
That's fair, and that's a good way to look at it, especially when we think about how this game is meant to be collaborative. You're working as a team, so you don't want to necessarily negatively impact people. Like in the session that I'm currently running, we have a few homebrew rules that we're using to kind of, you know, make it more flexible, given that we're working in a remote, like, game. Like, we're playing online and just joining together on Discord because my high school friends and I decided to jump back into a campaign and kind of continue like we had when we were playing in high school. But none of us live in the same state anymore, or even more than like 4 or 5 hours away from each other.
So if you picked up, like, if a current group decided they wanted to use rulebook one, like, mm-hmm. the actual beginning, they would find it too difficult?
No, I don't think they would find it too difficult. But if they've played fifth edition or any of the more recent editions, they may find it polarizing. There are things that happen in 5th edition now, like poison. Poison is essentially, you can be poisoned. It is a detriment to your character, but it's not instant death. In the first edition of Dungeons and Dragons, if you were poisoned, you just die.
And when you die in Dungeons and Dragons, unless you're like super high level and stuff, you can't come back to life. Like, you just die, and then you have to make a new character or leave the game.
Yikes.
Yeah, it's a, okay, but it's so much fun. It's a storytelling game at the end of the day, and that's what I love it for. I don't really care that much about the combat, although I feel like Baldur's Gate has helped me get good at actual combat for D&D.
Baldur's Gate. It'll come up later,
I will talk about it. I will. You can't stop me.
I don't want to stop you, but it will come back later in the discussion.
I was saying was that it's a collaborative storytelling game, and even with the modules and stuff, even though it is like a set story, every game that you play is going to be completely different, because on top of, you know, everybody's decisions that they make, like, nobody's going to make like the exact same decision. You also have these dice that determine whether or not you succeed at the things that you're trying to do, and that changes the story as well.
Yes, and we'll get into those shortly. But first, let's give a little bit more context of, we've kind of explained the DM and their purpose, but we haven't really talked about what the player is. So the player's role is to navigate this world through their actions, the success of which are determined by the use of 7 polyhedral dice, as Savannah was just talking about. Typically, you refer to these dice as D4, D6, D8, D10, a D10 percentile, which is used in conjunction with the other D10 to kind of simulate a 100-sided dice, a D12, and a D20. Saying D is just to say it is a die followed by the numeric value representing how many sides it has. So you have these 7 main dice that you use, D20 being the most common dice that is rolled to determine whether or not you succeed or fail in an action. But before any of that takes place, before any rolls or anything of that nature, players have to create their characters. And the first part of that is identifying what kind of race they want to be. Now, there is traditional fantasy fare like humans and elves and dwarves, but There's also more exotic creatures in Dungeons and Dragons, things like tabaxi that are catfolk, or tieflings who are the offsprings of humans with cambions and fiends. And once
devil people,
yeah,
with horns and colorful skin, yeah, they're really cool.
just nice guys. Nice guys have great resistance to fire. And once players have decided on what kind of race they want to be, then they go to their class. Now, you might want to think of the class in Dungeons and Dragons as essentially the job or the role that you will have in the game. And this is also going to determine the things that you're likely to excel at and the things that you're going to be a little less competent in. Classes in Dungeons and Dragons can range from more martial classes like fighters or rangers, or more magic-based classes like wizards or sorcerers. Once the player has both of these components determined, then you need to determine stats. Now, this is where our foreshadowing bit of Foley from earlier came in. Typically, to determine stats in Dungeons & Dragons, there's two primary ways that people do this. Either you do a point-by system, where you take 27 points and you equally divide them into six different stats. Alternatively, there is also rolling for stats, which is my preferred way to identify what skills I'm going to either be good at or, well, abysmal. Now, for those of you at home who obviously can't see what's going on, because this is a podcast and our ears are not our eyes. On my desk at the moment, I have a dice tray and I'm going to drop 4d6. Now, for context, in case you've forgotten what the D indicates, this is just four normal six-sided dice. When you're rolling for stats, you roll 4d6s and drop the lowest value. So if, for example, we were rolling to determine what kind of stats Rob's character... Rob, what's your character's name?
Biff.
Biff.
How did I... Oh my god, I knew you were going to say that.
Biff is one of my go-to character. Biff.
Biff, okay. As in, like, Back to the Future, Biff?
B-I-F-F.
Okay, yeah. Just making sure I'm good on spelling. I'm not going to write it down, but I want to know. So, Biff, what, you know, before we get some stats, tell me a little bit about Biff, Rob. I'm going to put you on the spot.
Biff.
D&D is a lot about Biff improv, so let's see your improv skills.
12 feet tall, but he only weighs 85 pounds. he blows over very easily. That's why he carries an enormous but very light shield made out of cat bones.
You killed cat people to make a shield out of them?
Yeah, he went over to Japan where all those cat people are.
Oh, nice.
Found the whole business a little offensive, so he's a little puritanical too, Biff.
Oh, Biff doesn't sound like a nice guy.
No, he's
not
at
offensive,
all.
But he's using their bones?
Well, yeah, because that shows his conquest of the, you know, cat people of Japan.
Canonically, Japan is in Faerun as of right now. So Biff, 12 foot tall, lanky, light as a feather.
Lanky is a generous way to describe it.
So what do you think, if you had to choose, let's kind of approximate it based off of what you think Biff would do in his everyday life if Biff was a real person, and then we can try and identify a class for Biff based off of that. So what do you think Biff does?
He looks around for pervy Japanese stuff, and he attacks it.
Perfect. All right, based on that little bit of knowledge, let's say...
You want me to improv. You're getting the straight,
and it's
the straight deal here.
Given that he has this sense of aggression towards the Japanese cat people, how?
No, he's willing to branch out into various other things, the pillow people and all that stuff. He'll go
aggression
there.
Toward them regardless, right?
The people pillow?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the ones that like to, yeah, you know what I'm
the
talking
sleep
about.
With the body pillows?
Yeah, yeah, he's after them too.
Okay, so let's call him a barbarian then.
I was about
barbarians
to say,
and Dungeons and Dragons.
A lot.
They excel in hitting things quite hard.
And
in acts
angry.
Of rage and being angry. So okay. I'm going to go ahead and roll these four dice. And the barbarian's primary stat happens to be its strength. So let's say... All right, so we got a... a one, a two, a two, and a three. So for point buy...
he's real dumb.
yeah, you typically drop the lowest value, so we'll drop our one. And that leaves us with a grand total of seven, which... the best possible outcome you could have got here is an 18, which is remarkably great. The worst possible outcome you could have got would be a 3. So,
all right.
You know.
Could be worse.
Yeah.
I'm like a D student.
Now, you've got this 7 as your points, and you're going to assign this to one of 6 different attributes that you think best matches for Biff. And then we would go through and roll... typically, you would roll 6 different times, take those 6 values that you calculated, and then assign them to your attribute or your core stats. But we're not going to worry about that for the sake of, boring the poor confessors to death.
Yeah, my goodness.
But I know. All they want to hear, they just want to hear about more of the antics of Biff. So your oh, key stats.
He gets up to some stuff.
I'm sure. We're going to have to talk about him again.
I don't think I want to play D&D with Rob anymore.
There's this whole thing that happened to him in South Texas. It was a disaster.
If anything, I want to play with him more now.
But so... the wind picked up, so it worked out for everybody.
He just kited him away.
Yeah, yeah. It was going to go badly.
You're like a tumbleweed.
Oh, God. Yeah. So your primary attributes that you choose from when you're creating your character are charisma, strength, wisdom, dexterity, intelligence, and constitution. Now... like we were saying, Biff being a barbarian, he's likely going to want to focus on his strength. Depending on the score you give to each stat will determine how good you are at completing tasks associated with it and what bonuses you receive, or what, you know, on the opposite end of the spectrum, if you get like a 7, what values are taken away when you roll to complete task. Often you want to prioritize the stats that better reflect the type of character you want to play. So like I said, giving that strength to Biff, or if you're a fighter and you're swinging your sword and striking down your foes, you'll also want to prioritize strength or even your constitution score so that you can keep yourself alive a little bit longer. If you're playing as a bard, you may want to prioritize your charisma so you can use your songs to inspire your party and build up the peers around you in the heat of battle. All of this is determining how your party is composed and how the players and the characters and essentially how everyone plans to play. The DM will then begin to set the scene. Maybe your party hasn't met each other yet and you all happen to be in the same tavern as a band of goblins attack and you band together to help the innocent bar patrons. Or maybe the DM has summoned you by, you know, having a powerful duke who's followed the exploits of you and your roaming band of adventurers, and they want you to strike down a dragon that's been wreaking havoc across the countryside. The beauty of the game itself is that it's theater of the mind, so it can be as wild as your own imagination is, and you can try anything as long as, you know, you happen to roll well enough. But question for you, Rob.
Mm-hmm.
And Savannah as well. Because it is a grim question, and it takes us back to the gentleman that we mentioned at the beginning. What does our imaginations and rolling dice with our friends have to do with two men who ended up taking their lives?
I mean, like, we want to say nothing, and I think that's probably mostly true. I mean, this feels like the beginning of the argument that violent video games caused violence, but that isn't really a new idea. It's many thousands of years old. It's anti-theatricalism, really, which, you know, Plato argued that we are engaging with illusions when we engage with reality. So why would we then go to the theater to engage with an illusion of an illusion? You know, and then there's all the Christian stuff. So what's interesting about this to me is that we're going to see the Christian right, I can tell already, is going to come after this theater of the mind, as you called it, Luke. But if we go back to Tertullian in the year 300, he came after the actual theater on a similar premise. He argued that the theater itself took us to dark places and led us away from Christ and, you know, made us, you know, think in terms of passions and sex and violence and made us act out violently. But he was wrong. I mean, that can't possibly be true. So, because we don't all go to movies and then go out and start slaughtering each other. So,
no, that would negatively impact ticket pricing.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Less people go to the movies, they're going to raise the prices up.
I don't want to say that I'm not open to the principle of desensitization. I think that is conceivable in terms of like pornography and violent media and stuff. Like people who see a lot of horror movies are less grossed out by them over time. However, that doesn't relate to the suicide problem here. Imagination, as a rule, creates possibility, and possibility, and I'm not a psychologist here, but possibility, right, is a reason to live, and the ability to think through possible outcomes of how things might go differently for you encourages you to carry on. So I'm kind of surprised.
I mean, I can also see the other aspect where you said in the intro that, like, because they became so engrossed in these fantasy worlds that they, like, didn't want to live in the real world anymore. And, like, I guess I can kind of see that as a reason.
Well, that's what was being pitched at the time.
Oh, okay.
But if you're dead, you're not living in any world. I mean, you are, I guess.
No, I wasn't trying to say that it was, like, I wasn't trying to say that I could see how that would be an argument, because there are definitely people that do get too engrossed into these fantasy things, but I don't think that it would necessarily also be on the game if that happened.
And
if that makes sense, too.
No, I think it makes sense, and I agree with you, because it, as we delve a little bit deeper into this, it'll give us more information about this kind of misunderstanding of the game and how people are viewing it in a less than ideal light. And one of those people happened to be Patricia Pulling, the mother of Irving Pulling, who ended up creating an organization called BAD, Bothered About Dungeons and Dragons, in 1983. Very similar to MAD.
Bothered?
Bothered About Dungeons and Dragons. Boy, am I bothered about Dungeons and Dragons.
Well, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I wonder if that was at a similar time, because that's MAD.
It was indeed.
Oh,
it was
okay.
Shortly after MAD. And partially due to the success of MAD. So BAD,
but drunk driving is objectively very dangerous.
No, you're not wrong.
Right.
I mean, I never drink and roll dice. That's for certain. It's not a risk I want to take.
No.
But BAD's goal was to spread information about spread information about the dangers of Dungeons and Dragons, arguing that playing D&D and its use of devils and demons and gods would lead America's youth down the path of the occult. Now, this is...
Woo!
I know, that lucky does. Us. Now, this is not necessarily what led both Pulling and Egbert to taking their lives. Unfortunately, Egbert was battling with both mental illness and addiction, and although he was a D&D player, its role in his death was that of hearsay, essentially of William Deere, the private investigator who his parents had contracted, who then convinced his parents that his death was due to his history of playing Dungeons and Dragons, and going as far as to suggest the possibility of foul play because of
it. What do you mean, like one of his friends killed him?
But the addiction? It's just like the addiction issues. That's a little bit like, I don't know, going into somebody's room and saying, oh, well, he went to a theme park. I can't figure out which one. There's this giant Mickey Mouse in the corner. But there's also this little Bugs Bunny. So this tiny Bugs Bunny on the bed suggests to me that it's probably universal. Never mind the giant mouse in the corner. Like, the addiction issue is obviously the biggest problem in the pack.
You would think. And Egbert, when he originally went missing from his dorm, ended up in a few different places. One of them was the sewers below his university, just kind of hiding out in the tunnels.
Not playing Dungeons and Dragons.
Not playing Dungeons and Dragons.
Right.
No.
This poor guy.
Although, I feel like it could be kind of cool to play it in, like, a creepy place like that.
It would be. Maybe not a sewer. Maybe somewhere that smells
Yeah, maybe not a sewer.
But...
Also, Rob, Bugs Bunny is Six Flags, not Universal.
Sorry, my mistake.
God, the disrespect.
Yeah, you should be.
For America's theme parks.
Yeah, I just have to correct it.
Does anybody care about Bugs Bunny anymore? He was big in the 90s. But
I do. I love Bugs Bunny.
Do the kids, though?
No, ask Corinne and Everett. Do they care about Bugs Bunny?
I mean, they're... No, they don't.
Well, his, I mean, Matilda
doesn't care about Bugs Bunny.
No, I think he's old. I think he's... Anyway.
I don't think any of my students do either.
No, I think Bugs may have left the building.
Yeah. There was rabbit season for one last time.
Oy.
But following his work with the parents of Pulling, Deer then used the hype around Egbert's death to write The Dungeon Master, The Disappearance of James Dallas Egbert III, recounting the events of Egbert's death from his own perspective. Not only did Deer end up creating a piece, profiting off of Egbert's tragedy, but another author.
Just pause you real fast? Where did the possibility of foul play come in?
I don't know.
Did you say that?
I did.
Oh, it just, he
I
just
wasn't
never
able to find it. Yeah, no, he.
Interesting.
William Deer, I encourage people to correct me because I love to be corrected. That's why I teach, so that I can continue to learn. But from what I could find while I was researching, is a lot of his work as a PI was speculation.
That seems like the opposite of I.
Yeah.
It's more P and not enough I.
He's...
He was just private.
He was just privating around and doing very little investigating.
Yeah. Now, that being said, Deer did have run-ins with Egbert and is the one who convinced him to go back home to his family. So it wasn't until after he had returned home that he did eventually take his life. So if anything, Deer wasn't even relevant in the case by the time that Egbert had passed. So
if I had to conjure a theory, though, it would be that somebody got carried away with the fantasy and that caused them to kill him and then stage his suicide. I'm just going to put that out
there. That would make sense. And
his family?
No.
The fantasy.
Like his family killed him?
One of the other players was too enthralled in the game. The game is no longer a game, it's real life type of situation. So
I understand.
Another author, Rona Jaffe, wrote Mazes and Monsters, a fictionalized story based on the events of Egbert's life, which led to then a direct-to-TV movie by the same name, starring none other than Occult Confessions' own favorite Hollywood dad, Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks, who portrayed the character Robbie in the movie, which was the character inspired by Egbert.
Wow.
Oh, no. Tom Hanks was in anti-D&D propaganda?
Young Tom Hanks.
What the hell, Tom?
He had some addiction issues in a Family Ties episode where he played Michael J. Fox's uncle, so he was also a basket of problems at that point in his fictional life.
That's fair. And now... Now he's passed it on to his sons. At least one of them. One of them's doing good. Yeah. Colin's doing good. Isn't the other one like a little bit of a goofball?
Okay. Yeah, he's a rapper or something.
Well, that's pretty cool. I don't know. I just remember some nonsense. Anyway, that's not important. The Tom Hanks drama is not important. But despite all the media...
It is important. It's important. It's just not germane.
Okay. Despite all of the media that followed Egbert's death, it wasn't until Pulling's organization BAD that D&D as a moral panic began to enter the mainstream. First, starting with lawsuits.
Could you just, sorry, real fast, yeah. Could you imagine with this poor guy where, like, you know, he's struggling with addiction and D&D has sort of been proven to be like this sort of therapeutic thing where, like, you can play it and kind of work through some of your issues in real life through this role play and stuff. Could you imagine him using this as his outlet to, like, try and get over, like, all of his bad shit? And then, like, after he dies, this asshole and his family are like, no, fuck that game. That game is the reason he died. Like,
yeah.
I just think that's really interesting.
And just disappointing and sad.
It is disappointing.
But
this poor guy, I feel bad for him.
It was the weird thing he did. You know, like, yeah. Drugs and stuff. Everybody knows, like, there's drugs everywhere. Oh, you do. People do the drugs. But this was weird, you know? So we always want to grab the thing that sticks out and place the blame on it.
That isolates him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, despite all the media following Egbert's death, it wasn't until Pulling's mother, Patricia, and BAD that the D&D panic really began to enter the mainstream. First, Patricia started with some lawsuits in regards to her son. She attempted to sue TSR, which, if you recall, was Gygax's company, the original publisher of Dungeons & Dragons, as well as Irving's principal, who was DMing for their campaign and cursed Irving's character, which his mother believed to be an actual curse.
By principal, God. Do you mean school principal?
School principal was That's DMing awesome. Their campaign.
That is so cool.
Cursed Irving's character. She attempted to sue said principal for cursing her son in a game.
But isn't that neat that he was hanging out cool? with the kids?
I do think it's cool. I mean, we have a Dungeons and Dragons club at our school. Kind of sweet. You know,
doing anything at all. It's just a nice idea that he's hanging out with the kids.
It is wholesome. It
was keeping him off the streets.
Yeah. Right. He's going
he's
the extra
there
mile.
Rolling dice, playing games.
After hours.
Aw. Yeah, and you know what? And D&D games last a minimum of like 4 hours when you play. So
I will say, at our middle school where I teach, the best club attendance for the entire school was the D&D club this year.
Just nice. Saying. Was that you?
Nice.
I co-run it, but
that's cool.
Having a small child makes it tougher. Aww. To, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm not there as often as I'd like to be. My attendance, poor. The kids' attendance, superb. Now, although she was trying to claim that Dungeons & Dragons was responsible for her son's death, both of these cases were thrown out of court. BAD then continued to work in conjunction with some conservative Christian outlets. They also appeared on 60 Minutes to warn about the evils of the game.
Oh, God, really?
Yeah.
Well, during the
Satanic
Panic, I just
feel like 60 Minutes was so...
They also
like,
had a guest appearance
on I just
picture
that being
Geraldo.
Like the height of...
So they were just going around...
But the
Geraldo?
Major Geraldo, yeah, the Donahue, the major media outlets were on board. They loved the Satanic Panic story. It wasn't about whether it was true or false. I mean, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. The question is it a cool story? And it was. It was engaging, and they all jumped on board in the first part of the 80s.
Yeah, my grandma, actually, I live with my grandparents at the moment, and I started playing Dungeons & Dragons, and I'll have, like, my coworkers from my other job come and play at my grandparents' house, and my grandma was like, yeah, your uncle was into that when he was younger, but then I saw on the news that it was evil and about devil worship, so I threw away all of his books.
They were not cheap books.
Like, no, they were not. And I know my grandparents bought them for him. So, but yeah, so apparently, like, my uncle was, like, super into it at one point and then fell off of it because my grandma literally was like, you're not allowed to play this, and threw away all of his books.
He never recovered.
No, she's cool with it now. But she did ask me, she was like, is it, like, she came up to me one night and she was like, I'm like, it's not about, like, devil worship or anything. And I was like, no, it's not. It's literally just a game where you pretend to be characters and fight evil. Like, it's like, it's so
and what
much
did she
fun,
say yeah. Whoops.
I don't know what she did. Whoops. I think she just kind of laughed and was like, yep, I guess I shouldn't have thrown away all those books, but This is the same grandma that went with me to the Star Wars hotel and like, was literally at like a LARPing hotel with me and was totally cool with that, but then was like, are you sure you should be playing this like dragon game? Like,
but even after these appearances, the tragedies continued. And an article from Dicebreaker.com, a relatively prominent board gaming site, there are two other instances where the panic around Dungeons & Dragons had kind of gone off the rails. In 1998, Chris Pritchard had conspired to murder both his mother and stepfather in order to receive his inheritance. His stepfather died in the attack, and his mother survived, but despite not being part of the murder, James Upchurch III and Gerald Henderson, who played D&D with Pritchard, were both convicted of aiding and abetting the murder.
What?
Did they?
No.
They were just because their only relationship, they played D&D so with the... him?
Mm-hmm.
And that was their only tie to him?
That was their tie to him. They were friends and they played D&D together.
That was it. Yep. Otherwise, they had no idea he was planning to murder anybody.
Yeah. Well, holy shit. How about this one? In 1984,
none of the alchemical actors should murder anybody then. I do not want to go to jail for that.
Yeah, we got to. Oof. There's a lot of them, too.
Yeah. That's why I mainly do remote stuff. It keeps me safe.
You would think. Yeah.
In 1984, Mary Towie had been murdered by Ron Adcox and Darren Molitor. When composing his defense, Molitor tried to include Dungeons & Dragons, saying that he had learned to play mind games that he wanted to use on Mary, and even stated that D&D had helped him desensitize from violence and lured him away from God. But that luring away from God is really what kicked the entire panic off. So, when Gygax and Arneson created Dungeons & Dragons, they included a variety of different monsters and beings within their game. But the three main groups that seem to ruffle feathers are the demons, the devils, and the gods. Demons, who are chaotic entities who only seek to destroy and cause harm. Devils, who are lawful to their own codes, but typically working to gain control over others, like on the mortal plane and things like that, make deals with the living, lure them into temptation. And the god in Dungeons & Dragons, or gods, I should say, are not the conventional god that we think of when we think of monotheistic religions like Christianity or polytheistic gods like those in Hinduism. No, these gods include Tyr, a lawful god of justice and heroism, or Moradin, the primary god of the dwarves, a god of creation, or Celemvor, the god of death, or even Lyria, a lesser goddess of joy, and coincidentally, the god of my life domain cleric, Gimlik. But in the eyes of organizations like BAD, the demons and the devils in Dungeons & Dragons are a way to lure players down a path of satanic corruption, while the gods in the game are to distract you from traditional Christian values. To the outside world, playing Dungeons & Dragons was a dangerous game, and those who were playing it had essentially given up on their own beliefs to inherit the beliefs of the game, much like members of a cult following the beliefs of their leader. However, and likely this comes as no surprise when we remind ourselves that Gygax and Arneson were, you know, both Christian, they did not have a cult in mind when they were working on creating Dungeons & Dragons. So alluring, you know, America's youth away from God was not exactly their intention. According to a 2007 post from Dragon's Foot Forum, from Gygax himself, he had stated that, "I didn't use anything from the Bible, as I consider that to be quite beyond the pale." Gygax was even a guest speaking during the Christianity and Gaming panel at Gen Con in 2007, the largest gaming convention in the U.S., to discuss how to deal with the misconceptions about the dangers of RPGs in general, and D&D in particular. To further Gygax's point, in an interview with the Canadian Broadcasting Company, our primary source author, Joseph Laycock, reflected on some of Gygax's actions in the creation of the game.
When Gary Gygax created the cleric class, he did not want to have his clerics worship the God of the Bible, because he didn't want to mix his religion with the game, because he respected it too much. He also made a class called the Paladin, a kind of holy warrior. So when the fearmongers looked at Dungeons & Dragons, they would say, "This isn't actually a game at all. This is a kind of religion. It is an occult, evil religion that is sort of masquerading as a game in order to lure in children.
Now, for context, a cleric in Dungeons & Dragons is a playable class that is an individual who had been chosen to represent their deity and has been granted the ability to cast spells and fight in the name of their god. In fact, as you continue to play as a cleric and level up the character, you gain the ability to impose divine intervention. At level 10, a cleric can reach out to their god in their time of need and make a request of them. For this to work, the player will need to roll a percentile dice. This is two d10s, one of which is numbered 1 through 10, while the other is numbered with each of its 10s, with each space on the die being 10s places. So you'll have 10, 20, 30, up until you get to 100, which is just denoted by two zeros. If you manage to roll either equal or lower than your cleric level, then your god will assist you. If not, your god just, you know, continues to go about their day and you get crushed and the rest of your party all die to the Tarrasque that you're fighting or were grossly unprepared for. But Rob, our dear friend Biff, he's had a change of heart. He wants to turn the other cheek. He's become a cleric. He's a cleric of Tyr. He's fighting just for pure justice and to eradicate all the body pillows from the planet.
That's my man.
It's a holy mission right there.
No, you gotta do it.
You're goddamn right. And in the process of doing that, Biff is met with an immovable force. So, Rob, I'm going to roll two d10s, similar to how I was just describing, and I'm going to tell you on whether Biff's plea to his god, Tyr, is going to be successful. But first, Rob, this is Biff's chance to destroy all the body pillows. What is Biff asking of his god?
That all the feathers in the world just vanish.
Yes, he's ignite. They must spontaneously combust all at once.
Right. So you get down. Biff is on his knees. Even on his knees, he's still heads and foot taller than people. And he's praying fiercely to Tyr. His cat bone shield strewn across his back. And we got a 39. Which is considerably higher than, in this case, it is higher than level 10, which is when you would initially get divine intervention. And because
you have to roll below your level, right? I'm sorry.
So Tyr hears this plea and says, "Nah, I'm good. You be right, Biff. Figure it out." And for 7 days, your god is not willing to hear your call again.
I understand.
Yeah. However, this ability to commune with one's god only continues to grow stronger as the cleric levels up. And by the time the cleric reaches max level in Dungeons & Dragons, which is level 20, they have an automatic success once they, call for divine intervention. So the feathers would, in fact, all spontaneously combust. If only Biff was a better cleric.
Well, just give us some time.
Yeah, that's all we need. And on the opposite end of the cleric primarily focusing on its ability to cast spells in the name of its god, we also had the paladin that Gygax and Arneson created, who's this holy avenger, essentially upholding an oath to represent their god in act. Essentially as an emissary for their god, striking down their foes with weapons and smites instead of, using magic. So when Dungeons & Dragons was created, there was no malicious intent to push the youth into a cult or send them into the arms of Satan, but to create a game that you can share with your friends and experience things that you may never otherwise experience in your life, and allow you to be whoever you want and explore the depths of your imagination. The moral panics of the 1980s ruled through fear.
Many people became fearful of Satanism or Satan worship in the early 1980s. and many activities that were once considered innocent or innocuous suddenly became potential vectors for the devil himself. Dungeons & Dragons, D&D, was pulled into that mass panic, fueled by a mix of television pundits, anti-D&D campaigners, and evangelical Christians. Even in major publications or on television programs, people would argue the game was responsible for suicides, murder, cannibalism, and torture.
Cannibalism?
Cannibalism!
I feel like that would have been on the news if someone was found being cannibalized, right?
You would think.
The satanic panic accusations, though, could get very wild without any evidence ever being produced. I mean, the original Michelle remembers, Michelle Smith made some crazy claims about child abuse and infant murder and terrible things, but there was no evidence for any of it, and for a while, nobody seemed to care.
That's insane to me.
It sounds
like
she
got such
a
good story.
Nat 20 on her persuasion check.
I mean, I don't know that we're any better today. Like, if you see a meme or something or a video on your Instagram scroll that tickles your particular politics and like feeds what you choose to believe, then you're inclined, I think, all of us are somewhat inclined to say, well, yeah, that sounds true.
I mean, I can see that. It's more so the case now than it was before, because the dissemination of information is so much quicker than it used to be, but it's also much easier to create false and fake information than it was before.
Yeah, I'll frequently like have to toggle back to a newspaper when I read something that I want to believe is true, but you know, as a scholar, I have a very strong spidey sense about things that are not true, and then it just won't be there. And it's sad for me.
I've spent a lot of time on the internet and I feel like now, no. Yeah, I know. But I feel like I've started to like now when I used to be like that where I'd see a video and be like, holy crap, I can't believe that this is real. And now I'm learning that most of the time it actually is not real. And like all those like videos of like Karen's freaking out and all that other stupid crap like that. Like, I feel like a lot of the times it's not real anymore. And there's been telltale signs of that too. So like, I feel like I'm now more so less inclined to believe anything I see. And I have to find proof that it's real before I start being like, oh my God, it's real. But yeah, I mean, but that's also just the culture that we live in at the moment. So.
But I guess I just want to say we're no better than the people of the 80s in that way. Like, we can look back at them and be like, oh, these benighted fools, but we do it too.
We do.
I mean, if anything, we're due for another satanic panic anyway.
Oh, oof. They're kind of come after us first, man, so be careful what you say.
It's fine. I need something to keep me busy in the summer anyway.
We can run across country together from the people with their pitchforks.
That could be good. As we enter into the 1990s, Patricia Poling has stepped down from her position in BAD and removed herself from the media sphere, and the overall panic around Dungeons & Dragons has begun to dwindle, and the game has continued to grow in popularity since. Now, Dungeons & Dragons is a household name. From its role in the Netflix series Stranger Things, helping to give names to the horrors that are plaguing Hawkins, Indiana, the 2023 film Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves, which, even if it did underperform a little bit in sales, was still a fun romp through Faerun.
That movie rocked. I loved that movie. I saw it like two or three times in the movie theater. I love that movie.
I liked it a lot. Dungeons & Dragons is even filling our ears through various actual play podcasts like Critical Role or Not
Critical
Another
Role.
D&D podcast.
I like love Critical Role also so much. And Dimension 20. I haven't watched as much Dimension 20 as I have Critical Role. I'm sitting in my room right now. Honestly, if I were to die right now, someone might assume that Dungeons & Dragons and Critical Role killed me with all the stuff that I have in my room based off of it.
That's what I would tell them.
Terrible timing since you'd be recording an episode. But amazing publicity for the podcast.
Yeah, that is true. I'll take a bullet for the
team. Somebody murder Savannah.
It wasn't us. It was not us. We were not involved. However, it definitely had something to do with Dungeons and Dragons.
It's okay, Savannah. We can cast Revivify and get you back.
Oh, good.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, these shows like Dimension 20 and even Dungeons and Daddies, which is a very loose take on the D&D 5th edition rule set, it's the foundation of amazing video games too, which I know Savannah is very excited to talk about Baldur's Gate, especially Baldur's Gate 3 and its implementation and slight modification of Dungeons and Dragons 5th edition. But the game itself managed to win 32 different awards since its release in 2023.
Because it's the best game ever made.
It is pretty darn good. I won't dispute that. It is. I don't know when it will be dethroned. I think it will be inevitably. But it is currently my favorite game of all time. Eventually, something else will come along. But for now.
Well, but to that point, though, all along this history, there have been role-playing games. Like, in America, we had Dragon Warrior. I had Dragon Warrior as a child. And we had Final Fantasy. And these, I mean, you guys talk about Dungeons and Dragons, and I keep thinking about these games, some of the things you're saying. Like, the RPGs are very much like this Dungeons and Dragons world, but were they caught up at all? I feel like they completely skated away from this because they're Japanese in origin, although they're based on a Japanese concept of Western medievalism.
Well, then they should watch out for Biff.
They should watch out. Yes, well, no. Biff is totally wandering around the Dragon Quest world, making sure everything remains on the up and up.
That's good. I think, and this is speculation from my perspective, I think things like Dragon Quest and, you know, the Final Fantasy series, which is extremely expansive. I mean, or things like Fire Emblem, even. These games, I think it's because it was not coming, direct. It was coming to America, but not from America.
So it's the Americanness of it, the Japaneseness of it, is what allowed it to skate free. Because I feel like the Dragon Quest, which again was Dragon Warrior, was probably 85 or 86. It's at the tail end of the Satanic Panic, but still in there.
Yeah, I mean, the first Baldur's Gate game, which was published by BioWare, came out in 1998. And then also use the Dungeons and Dragons rule set. And yes, that's the late 90s, almost into the 2000s, but it didn't bat an eye. And then the sequel came out in 2000, and still no qualms with that.
Aren't these like video games that you guys are talking about, though?
They
like
are.
Dragon Quest and Fire Emblem.
But they all revolve
like
around
Dungeons
the same
and Dragons is
ideology. I mean, it's the same magic world, the same spells and gods and
demons. Yeah, but I think there's something to the fact that with Dungeons and Dragons, you have to come together to meet, and you're playing it in real life. And as you're there, like, when you're playing the game, the DM and you as your character are being other people. Like, you're not yourselves, you're acting as other people. And like, my grandmother even said, like, when me and my friends were sitting around the table, that it looks like a little satanic, but we were literally just sitting around a table getting ready to play a board game.
That's interesting.
So it's like
the ritual of it is what makes it more threatening.
It is very ritualistic, honestly.
Looks like a seance.
I have a weird ritual that I do, like, with my dice. Like, whenever I take my dice out of the bag, I have to, like, set each one out individually and, like, make sure they're on the highest values. That's probably just because I'm crazy. But, like, there's also things, like, everybody has, like, everybody brings, like, their own, like, little notebooks to take notes. People talk in funny voices. Like, I try to use funny voices when I DM and stuff, and my coworkers use silly voices. I mean, actually, and then the Alchemical Actors, when we all play together, also use silly voices. We aren't ourselves when we play the game, even though we are, but we try our best to be like in character when we play the game. And I feel like that's the biggest difference, is that it's in real life, there's multiple people, and that it does feel ritualistic in a way, because everybody has their own little like ritual that they do when they come to play Dungeons and Dragons, it seems like.
Yeah, it's in your basement in a more palpable way than on the old TV set.
Well, we play in the dining room at Breeze and my grandparents.
Yeah,
so
that's less threatening, I hate to tell you.
That's
but
okay.
It's so much
I don't
more accessible to snacks that way.
The snacks are handier.
It is. Yeah, I feel like D&D itself even has, like, I know we're talking about the satanic panic and stuff, but I even think that it has, like, a little bit of cultiness to it, where it's like you play once a week or you play once every 2 weeks and you have to meet at, like, the exact same time at the exact same place, and if you miss a day, like, everybody gets pissed off.
I mean, there are campaigns that last years with the same players meeting every single week, or I can't remember when I was reading it, but there was a campaign that had lasted over 20 years between the same group of players that were just play.
That's amazing. I strive to be like that.
I strive to have friends for 20 years. But you're not wrong. There are what an outside perspective might look at as, like, culty components in the nuances and the different parts of the game that people really enjoy, like the getting together, the camaraderie, the little tiny rituals, like the fact that people are moving miniatures if you're using minis when you play, and people are pretending to be things like that they're not.
I bought, like, a little wooden jail to put our dice in if they roll bad and stuff. Yeah, I think it's important to say that it's a big difference, because with Dungeons and Dragons, for the most part, you're playing in person with actual people, whereas with a video game, you're playing by yourself, and video games can be taboo, and I know I've been part of, like, this sort of satanic thing panic before, but, like, it's not the same thing as Dungeons and Dragons.
No, and video games have had their own panics, especially with violence, and that's something that, you know, we could save for another day, but... You know, as D&D becomes more and more accessible and published in mass media, it just continues to grow. And, like, tools like Roll20 and D&D Beyond, they'll help you to play the tabletop game without a table or even being in the same room as another person. In fact, Wizards of the Coast, who, as you recall, own the rights currently to Dungeons & Dragons, estimated that as of 2023, over 50 million people have played D&D. And... like I said before, I've been playing for 17 years, and I don't think I'm in a cult. I don't think I'm being consumed by the devil or have the urge to kill or harm others. Instead, I just feel joy and happiness, and it's a role-playing game that's just given so many people the ability to be themselves in a way that they've never been
before. When you say cult, I mean, what's interesting about the application of the word here is that there is no leader. I mean, was there ever any focus on Gygax or anyone as the leader of the cult?
His role in a lot of the social forums, like his appearances at Gen Con and things like that, people would look up to him and pose multiple questions to him, but they weren't like sycophants. They just wanted to know more about the game, or, you know,
did the anti-campaign like bring him up?
Not that often. Yeah. There were some instances where he was brought up. TSR ended up getting a psychologist to represent them to show the actual benefits of playing Dungeons and Dragons versus the negative implications that had been kind of pushed upon them by the press.
Yeah, it's just sort of bizarre. Like, without a leader or a leadership structure, a hierarchy, it's very hard to conceive of it in any terms as cult-like. I mean, as opposed to we just did multi-level marketing where there's an obvious hierarchy, but not here.
Yeah, I mean, in this case, the only hierarchy, because these are all individual games, they don't all share within each other. The only hierarchy is the players and the DM.
Right.
And
yeah,
even
I was about to say, it's
regard,
a bunch of their own little individual cults.
Yeah, it's, but even in that regard, the players in the DM should not be looked at on two different planes. The players in the DMs, they are nothing without each other. Like, they have to function together. And so, yes, the DM has typically quite a lot more to think about and plan out. They don't exist without the other and vice versa.
Yeah, people, like, there's a lot of DMs that, like, you know, there's like horror stories of like bad playing D&D or whatever, and there's horror stories of DMs being like, well, I don't like that you did that, so we're going to change that, where it's like, well, if you don't like that the way the story is going based off of the players, you should write a book.
Yeah, and either that or just don't DM for them.
Yeah, and
find
it's just,
other people.
D&D isn't meant to be this collaborative storytelling thing, and I really, really enjoy it for the fact that it's a collaborative storytelling between, like, the party, between the DM, and almost between, like, the universe itself, because the dice determines so many different things as well, that it's like the universe gets a say in your story as you're playing it. Like, it's, oh my god, it's such a good game. I seriously love it so much.
You know, that may be one of the most religious things I've ever heard you say.
It's been...
as we begin to kind of like wrap this up, Savannah, I think we would be remiss if we didn't have Rob roll a d20.
For what? What's he doing?
Well, obviously it's not what Rob's doing.
But
what
Biff is doing.
Oh yeah, what is Biff doing?
Let's think for a moment. Let's really riff on Biff. Biff, after being dismissed from Isgard.
Yeah. He's got to find some other avenue. Maybe he gives up.
at least until Isgard is willing to
listen. He gives up on the body pillows because he sees there's no way forward there.
All right. And as he's making that decision, and Biff is... he's walking down like a back alleyway, and you know, the skittering sounds of cats all around him. I want Biff to just make a perception check. So your perception is just your ability to see things that are going on, and you perform that by rolling a d20 and then adding a modifier that's reflected of your intelligence. But Biff, you know, Biff is Biff. But we didn't roll for intelligence, so I'm just going to pretend that Biff has a flat 10, so he has no modifier on it. And, you know, Rob, if Biff perceives, then I'm going to give you one last little bit of the story. And if not, we're going to leave all of the confessors. The
they'll have to imagine what happens to Biff.
Would you like
what
to know
did
what
I
you rolled?
Roll?
On the d20, you rolled an 18.
So I did Ooh. Perceive them.
You did.
Whoa,
because
he perceived.
He perceived. And what is it that you perceive?
You
perceive on the ground, just tucked under a trash can in this dark alley, is a tiny piece of paper that says, "Thank you for listening to this episode of Occult Confessions."
Oh, Biff really got let down there.
Don't worry, so did everyone else.
I hereby adjourn and declare closed this meeting of the Secret Order of Alchemical Actors until such a time as we get together and do it again. Luke, who was joining us today?
You were joining us.
That's
as
true.
Well as the ever-fantastic Savannah Verrett.
I didn't get to talk enough about Baldur's Gate. I'm disappointed.
I'm sorry. Our voice actor today representing Joseph Laycock was Andrew Mims, also known as...
Oh. Yes.
Yes. All right. Well, fair enough.
Correct. We can't say his.
We can't say his name. No, that's part of the lore.
Oh. I was just like.
I didn't know we made a licking
it.
Sound.
I know. I just wanted something to fill the void.
Okay, that's fine. Well, now you got to say your name and that you're out of here.
Oh, and I am Luke Kinneman, your producer at Discordia. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.